Okay, so you can see we left all the technical presentations for last, so I hope the sugar of the KitKat is now in your bloodstream. Okay, the last presentation of the day is being presented by Ronald Richman. Ronald's going to join us online. Ronald is the chief actuary at Old Mutual Insurance. He holds a practice certificate both in short-term insurance and life insurance. And he's got a Master's of Philosophy in Actuarial Science with distinction, I have to add. Ron also chairs the Actuarial Society ERM Committee, and he's also on the Austin Board, so well-versed with what is happening in the international arena. And Ron will be discussing today with us his new paper around a new approach on discrimination-free insurance pricing. Thanks, Ron. Welcome.
Hi, everyone. Thanks, Sias, for the warm welcome. Just checking you can hear me in the room.
Yes, we can hear you fine.
Okay, so I'm just going to turn my video off and then start presenting. So I'm very glad that discrimination-free pricing doesn't exist in any of the FSIs yet. So hopefully there won't be any difficult references I'll have to remember. And really what the title of the presentation today is Discrimination-Free Insurance Pricing, Old and New. So we'll be covering just what is discrimination-free insurance pricing and why should we care about it. We'll look at one example. Then we'll talk about the new aspect of this work, which is what do we do in cases of missing data and how do we deal with that? And then we'll look at a final example. So hopefully everyone will enjoy it. There's quite a lot of fundamental pricing concepts in here. And I hope that will be satisfactory. I'm very also happy to take questions during the talk or after, so just let me know if there's anything in the room or online that I should address. What is the rationale for discrimination-free pricing? This is work that we've done together with Mario Woodruff, Matthias Lindholm, and Andreas Tsarnakis, and you can see some of the papers that we've written on the screen, and you're welcome to read these. They're all open access. So what is the rationale? Why should we care about this as actuaries? So there's a quite a well-known insurer in the US called Roots. They actually haven't done so well recently on the stock market. But what they did, and they had a big advertising campaign a couple of years ago where they said, let's drop credit score out of our pricing models. And what the claim that they made is that historically under-resourced communities and other people who may be somewhat marginalized may have terrible credit scores, but that's not necessarily a good link to their driving ability. So they said, let's drop the score. Let's rather use telematics information, which will more directly reflect the risk. And really what they're saying can be summarized in the sort of diagram that I'm showing on the bottom right-hand part of the screen. This is, the technical term is a directed acyclic graph, which is popular in causal inference, and we'll discuss this a little bit more. But really what it's saying is your insurance price is determined by your credit score, but that credit score variable itself can be determined by two different things. The one thing it could be determined by is if you a person from a marginalized group, such as an immigrant, you may have a bad credit score, and that's got nothing to do with your driving. But there's also a very famous paper which analyzes why should we include credit score within pricing models, and it relies on something called sensation-seeking and self-control theory. And people who are more sensation-seeking often will have both lower credit scores and worse driving experience. And that's perhaps a more actuarially reasonable reason why you'd want to include credit score in your pricing models. So you can really summarize the situation that what Root is talking about in their press release is credit score can reflect both valid and invalid risk characteristics. Another one, I think this is a picture of Johannesburg, and you can see the dramatic geospatial inequality that's captured by this photo. So on the left, you've got a relatively higher income area, on the right, you've got a lower income area. But I think we all know that due to the legacy of apartheid, which still is with us today in South Africa in 2022, there's a strong correlation between geographic factors and race. So if you look at the diagram on the left-hand part of the slide, there's very good reasons why you'd want to include postal code or suburb within a pricing model because it can reflect geographic factors. But unfortunately, it may also be reflecting racial factors because your geography is often determined by race in South Africa, and therefore that might be another reason you might want to start making sure that you don't have some sort of discriminatory bias within your models. So let's just run through a couple of background points. So in the current environment, I think we all know that more advanced techniques are becoming more widely known and used. At the same time, there's increasing scrutiny internationally on pricing practices. So there was a big review of price walking last year in the UK, and that's now banned. There's currently an EIOPA question and panel that's sitting on exactly the same item. And I think overall, there's just more and more awareness that decisions made algorithmically may not always result in fair and equitable and just outcomes for everybody. In terms of legal and ethical requirements, there's a legal requirement in the EU not to price using gender. I think in South Africa, it's more around ethical concerns that one could have. And I think everyone would be horrified if any insurer's pricing model actually included ethnicity or race, because that would clearly be illegal. But how can we also ensure that our models are not being influenced by discriminatory factors indirectly through the proxying effect that we described before? So a naive solution, and hopefully what everyone is doing in the room when you do your pricing, is you just ignore the problem by leaving out the discriminatory rating factors. And the key question we'll cover in this introduction is, could some advanced models figure out proxies for these discriminatory rating factors? And the answer that we're going to see is that even very simple models can be shown that they do this, and that we'll look at a simple example of that soon. So what is the EU legal basis? So in the EU, there's two things that are banned. You can't have direct discrimination on the grounds of gender, but you're also not allowed to have indirect discrimination. And that indirect discrimination basically refers to where you have an apparently neutral practice, such as a pricing model that's got nothing to do with gender, that nonetheless puts people of one gender or one sex at a particular disadvantage compared with persons of other sexes. So the first part is talking about directly including discriminatory characteristics within pricing models. And what, for example, we normally see is gender is quite a significant risk factor in non-life and life insurance. And then in terms of indirect discrimination is what happens if you include other factors within your pricing model that are highly correlated with the discriminatory factor. What I think is becoming more and more well known is that your models can pick up a lot of the same effect from these other correlated factors. Maybe just an important thing to note, this presentation isn't about what should be a discriminatory factor. I think actuarial expertise is perhaps best used in terms of working out how can we build models to deal with this problem, as opposed to trying to work out what is or isn't a discriminatory factor. In the EU, the society has chosen that as gender, but I think common between the EU and South Africa is you definitely can't have direct discrimination with, for example, ethnicity. So let's just run through a couple of definitions, and we'll be using these throughout the talk. So insurance pricing models usually take the form of conditional best estimates plus a risk margin. So your best estimates are normally either claims costs or frequencies or severities. Just going to refer to exactly what you're trying to predict as Y. You also have non-discriminatory covariates called X and discriminatory covariates, which we're going to call D. So the definition mathematically of your best estimate price, and this is what we're targeting in our GLMs or whichever other models we might be using, is you want to get a price that depends both on your non-discriminatory and discriminatory covariates X and D, and that's a conditional expectation, or maybe let's not use mathematical jargon, that's just your regression model, which takes in X and D and predicts Y. For complex lines of business like personal lines in this country, you'll use a GLM or a regression model. But I think what's clear is that this best estimate price using both X and D will automatically discriminate based on the discriminatory characteristics. So the naive approach, which we call unawareness prices, really ignores D, and you just hope that X and D are uncorrelated. And that's shown in the notation on the bottom of the slide. So let's think about a problem with unawareness. And this is a really, really simple, health or life insurance pricing problem. Let's say we've got 112 claims and 589 exposures. And what we'd like to do is we don't want to price with gender. We just want to differentiate by smoking status. What you could do very simply is take the 36 smoker claims divided by the 157 smoking exposures, and that's going to give you a frequency of 0.229. But if you look at the data, you'll see that both our exposures and claims in this particular example are more skewed towards women. In other words, women have a higher probability of being a smoker. And if you do a little bit of conditional probability, you can show that this unawareness price for the smoker frequency can be decomposed into a set of prices, which is really the male smoker rate and the female smoker rate multiplied by the probabilities of each smoker. Given that you're a smoker, then what's the probability of being a woman? What's the probability of being a man? So effectively, this unawareness price implicitly infers gender based on your smoking status, and that is really indirect discrimination. So this is probably the most simple pricing model you'll ever encounter in non-life insurance. And even in this particular example, you can show that, hey, there's some element of indirect discrimination just based on the nature and the way in which people are allocated to the smoker and non-smoker categories. So let's think about what should a good discrimination-free insurance price look like. So on the left-hand side, we've got some information about a new portfolio. And in this particular portfolio, it's what's the probability that you're female at each age? And you can see that that is 90% up to age 50, and then 10% of being a female from age 60 and onwards. In other words, 90% being male in this particular example. And the population average is 50% throughout. And let's suppose that females have increasing claims costs with age, going from 100 to 120 or so, and males with decreasing claims costs going from 100 to about 80 by age of 100. And maybe the audience can think, and yeah, we're very happy if anyone wants to venture a guess, what should the discrimination pre-price be here? So I can't see the room, so I'm just going to carry on, but hopefully everyone had a small chance to think about this. I think the discrimination-free price and what we would propose is that it's the yellow line. In other words, you don't take into account the gender at each particular age and the portfolio is split. You price in such a way that you don't use age as a proxy for gender. The unawareness price, if you've generated claims costs using this information before, would actually track almost exactly with the actual claims costs. And in that particular instance, your unawareness price is almost a perfect proxy for the discriminatory factors that you may not be allowed to use according to law. So this is another example, both of unawareness prices acting as proxies, but another interesting thing, what could a potential discrimination-free insurance price be? So let's define the discrimination-free insurance price. So the intuition is that we want to decouple these things. We want to decouple age and gender proportions in this particular example. And more generally, what we want to do is decouple your discriminatory characteristics from your non-discriminatory characteristics. And the procedure that we propose is actually calculate your best estimate prices using both X and D. In other words, gender or ethnicity in your GLM. And then what you should do is take a weighted average of your prices where the weights are independent of any information around the non-discriminatory characteristics. So the way that you do that, let's say you've got a non-life pricing data set, you'll fit your GLM. Let's say we're in the EU, you'll include gender, so you'll have male and female. And then what you do is you predict a price for males, you predict a price for females for each record, and you average these out using an overall population distribution of the discriminatory characteristics. Most importantly, and what it's worth emphasizing in the procedure that we propose, is you don't use the conditional probability of being a male or a female given the other characteristics. And by not conditioning on the non-discriminatory characteristics, what that effectively means is that we break the link, and then your unawareness prices or your discrimination-free prices will no longer act as proxies, just like your unawareness prices do. I'm not going to go into the formal definitions here. If anyone's interested, you can read the paper in the Aston Bulletin. So let's go back to example one. What we want to do is now calculate a discrimination-free insurance price for our smokers. And the way that you go about that is, first you'd calculate your rate for female smokers, so 32 over 133. I wonder if I can get a pointer here somehow. Okay, no pointer. Just have to make do. So the way you do that is you calculate 32 smoker claims over 133 exposure claims, exposures for females. Similarly, you calculate a rate for males, 4 out of 24. But the proportions that you'd use over here is what's the probability of being a woman overall? That's 264 out of 589. And what's the probability of being a male overall in your portfolio? That's 325. And if you do this procedure, what you then land up finding is your discrimination-free price is 0.2 because you're no longer giving weight to your female smokers who have higher claims and of whom there are more in this particular portfolio. So that's almost our first simple example done. Here's a way of calculating a discrimination-free insurance price. Let's talk about how we can justify this procedure. So a lot of the work that we do as actuaries is all around correlations. What you do is you fit a GLM, you fit a machine learning model, and the point really is that you hopefully pick up some correlations in your data and you can use that to price. And what we're really not interested about is causality. The one place where there's an exception in non-life practice is in price optimization, where you may very well want to do something like a random controlled trial and see how can you vary your prices. But generally, we're not interested in causal inference. In other disciplines that use statistics, people are very interested in causation, and you spend a lot of time trying to infer, does a particular drug do a particular thing? And can you infer causality based on the type of data that we have in insurers, which is observational data? You actually can, and there's a fantastic introduction to this in the Book of Why by Judea Pearl and Dana McKenzie. So what you need to do is you actually need to control for variables that lead to the sort of selection bias and confounding of variables that we discussed at the beginning when we were talking about root and when we were talking about South Africa. And the way that you do that is very much around these sorts of diagrams that I mentioned before. In this particular case of our pricing example, we think both D and X, both your discriminatory and non-discriminatory characteristics, influence your price. And what we would like to do is break the link between D and X. In other words, you don't want there to be any link between the discriminatory characteristics, D, and the non-discriminatory characteristics, X. So this formula to do this is called Pearl's backdoor adjustment to remove confounding effects. And if anyone's done any machine learning in the audience, this is also the same formula that you use for the partial dependence plot for machine learning interpretability. And what all of these things are trying to do is really find the effect of X on Y after removing the effect of D on X. And just in English, that's finding the effect of your non-discriminatory characteristics only on the price after you remove the confounding effect of your discriminatory characteristics on your non-discriminatory characteristics. So hopefully that gives a little bit of insight. Let's look at our first full example. So this is actually a health insurance setup, but shouldn't be too different from what we do in non-life. We have got both in terms of our non-discriminatory characteristics, we've got age and smoker status. Our discriminatory characteristics are gender. And the claims costs over here are birthing costs, which only affect females between certain ages, cancer costs, which depend on age, and there's a higher frequency for both smokers and women, and then other costs which only depend on age. The total costs in this particular toy example are the sum of these three items that I've just mentioned. What we did is we simulated a portfolio of 100,000 policyholders. We assumed 45% are women. And then what we did is we induced correlation into your covariance. So in other words, we said the probability of being a smoker overall is 30%, but the probability of being a smoker, given that you are a woman, is 80%. So there's many more female smokers than male smokers. This is an example directly using the underlying formula we use to generate the claims. And this is an example of discrimination-free unawareness and best estimate prices. We've got smokers on the left, non-smokers on the right. And let's just have a look at what we're seeing over here. So we see that the costs for women are higher than the costs for men. That's the black line on the top of the panel. The red line on the bottom is costs for only for men. Your unawareness price tracks the smokers, the best estimate price for women. And remember in this particular case that the probability of being a woman, given that you're a smoker, is 80%. So smoker status acts as a pretty good proxy for gender, as you can see. And then finally, the discrimination-free price, you can see is somewhere in the middle of the distribution, and that's not being affected. It's not using smoker status as a proxy. Similarly, on the right-hand panel, you can see that in this particular case, the unawareness price tracks males because there's more males in the distribution. If we switch things around and we said that the probability of being a man, the probability of being a woman, given that you are a smoker, is only 0.2, in this particular case, you can see things switch around exactly as you'd expect, and your unawareness price tracks males for smokers and females for non-smokers. On this particular slide, we're showing what happens if you fit GLMs and neural nets to this claims data that in this generated portfolio. So we've got neural nets on the top. Let's talk about the neural nets. They can obviously fit the underlying experience really well. You can see the best estimate prices look pretty good, as do the discrimination-free and unawareness prices. What this really tells you is with a suitable algorithm that fits your data well, you can quite easily calculate discrimination-free prices. On the bottom, what we show is a simple GLM. You can see in this particular case, the GLM doesn't reproduce the underlying data particularly well, but even within the context of a GLM model, still your discrimination-free prices don't track the experience and don't use smoker status as a proxy for gender. So that tells you something about model risk, that even if you don't have a good model, that doesn't mean you will discriminate, at least from the perspective of the model. Let's just talk a little bit about bias correction. So a major reason that we use GLMs in non-life pricing is because they produce unbiased portfolio costs, unless you want to start modifying your base rates within your models for changes in experience. Unfortunately, by using discrimination-free insurance pricing, you lose the unbiasedness property because you don't charge people the price implied by the experience. You are modifying the implied price using the procedure that we just discussed. So what you need to do is correct for the bias to allocate all the portfolio costs. There's a particular way you can do this. It can be additive. It's also quite nice just to use a ratio where you ratio up each price by the proportion of the bias. Or if you want to be really fancy, you can also adjust the probabilities you use to average out your models to calculate the discrimination-free price. And this bias correction allocates the cost across portfolio across the portfolio as a whole, instead of to a particular protected group. So let's conclude the first section of the talk. Let's conclude the old. So what have we shown today? This is a method that can be used as a drop-in to remove any unwanted or illegal discrimination from pricing models. I think it may have applications wider than pure insurance pricing. For example, anytime you've got a predictive model like triaging patients in hospital, you might want to use this sort of procedure. But a big problem is you have to know the discriminatory variables D. And if you don't know the discriminatory variables D, then you can't actually apply our method directly. And this becomes very tricky. It's very hard to ask everyone when you're signing them up for insurance about what their ethnicity or race or sexual orientation is, if you'd like to make sure that you're not indirectly discriminating. And this is a problem that we're going to turn to in the second part of the presentation. Just one or two words, what could this mean for South Africa? And I'm very interested in feedback from the audience, given that this is the stick. I mean, I think we know that pricing with gender is legally acceptable in South Africa, and most pricing models directly discriminate. You obviously don't use race within rating models, so most pricing models are actually using the unawareness price. Do we think that indirect discrimination might be a problem? So when could this be problematic? I think probably with geographic variables that could be highly correlated with race, and credit scores also may reflect racial biases in South Africa. So companies could investigate if there is a material impact of this within their pricing, and of course they could then remove it with this discrimination-free pricing method. So now let's talk about the case of missing data and multitask neural networks, and this is the new item in the presentation I'd like to present you today. So as we said, the discrimination-free procedure needs data on your discriminatory characteristics, because the way the procedure works is calculate your best estimate prices using a model like a GLM or a neural net, and then take a weighted average of the prices where the weights are now independent of your non-discriminatory characteristics. But it's often the case, like we know, that D isn't available. So it's very difficult to collect highly sensitive data such as ethnicity or race, even if the only goal with which you're doing this is to reduce potential discrimination. So then how can we apply discrimination-free pricing if we don't have access to D for the whole portfolio? So this new proposal that we're going to show to you now in the second part of the presentation is, can we adapt the neural networks that we used before to work in the case of missing discriminatory information? And the answer is obviously going to be that we can. So just a very quick, brief reminder about neural nets. On the right-hand part of the slide is a GLM shown in neural network diagram format. Each circle is a variable. Each line is a regression coefficient. So the way that you'd represent this as a GLM is you've got a single output, you've got 8 input variables, you've calibrated 8 coefficients in your pricing software, and this is basically nothing more than a GLM. A deep neural net is a very similar model, actually, and in this deep neural net, you've got multiple layers. The circles still represent variables, the lines still represent regression coefficients, but instead of directly connecting your outputs to your inputs, you have these two intermediate layers, and within these intermediate layers, you perform a nonlinear transformation of your input data, and this nonlinear transformation allows the network to learn a representation of the data such that you can have a very accurate output from the network, and these things are very good for prediction. So just something that I'd love to see happen more is actually starting to use neural nets more in their work. And the reason for this is neural nets are actually just generalizations of GLMs. If you remember what we said, the way these things work is you feed your data in, and the two intermediate layers learn a new representation of your data. Your actual predictions are made by GLM on top of this last layer of hidden variables of the network. So really all that a GLM is, all that a neural network is just a fancy feature extractor model on top of a GLM model. There's a very nice mathematical representation for this, that all a neural network is just a fancy feature extractor composed of a number of layers Z. This is the formula on the bottom left-hand part of the slide that takes in an input X and gives you a new representation of your data. You then use that in a GLM. So something that we don't deal with too much in the usual models we have in short-term insurance is multi-output or multi-variable models. So most actuarial models output a single variable like frequency, severity, pure premium, or if you're in the reserving world, a single loss development factors. There are much more general classes of models with multivariate outputs. And perhaps one, the only example in non-life insurance I can think of is the Munich chain ladder method, which provides an LDF both for paid and incurred. But what the point of a model like this is in the neural network world is there's a shared representation in this in the last layer of the network. So in other words, what you'd like to do is predict two outputs over here. You can see there's two outputs in the diagram on the right-hand part of the slide, and each of those outputs benefits from the representation learning or the feature extraction performed by the first part of the network. So you don't need to train different models for each output. You can train one joint model. So how do you actually go about training these models? Usually you supply examples of the same dimension of the output. You can see the gray dots on the extreme right-hand part of the slide in the middle. Those are your examples. And what you do is you try to ensure that the neural network predicts both examples that you give it well using a relevant loss function. And the sort of terminology that you have is on the bottom right-hand part of the bottom left-hand part of the slide. You're looking for parameter vector theta, which minimizes the loss function between your observations and what the network produces. So what happens if you're now missing some data, and you'll see that we've crossed out one example? What we need in the case of discrimination-free pricing is we need to predict a price for each level of your discriminatory characteristics. So, for example, males and females in the gender variable. How can we train a network to produce outputs for all levels of the discriminatory characteristics if we only observe a single level, D, for a particular record? And the way that you do this is you adapt the loss function to this special case using an indicator variable. And what you basically say, without referring to the mathematical side of it, is if this is a node of the network where you have an example, try to get that to match as well as you can. And if you don't have an example, just set that equal to zero. That's what the formula in the middle of the left-hand part of the slide says. You're trying to find your parameter vector that minimizes your loss function only where you actually have a single live example. So what this really means is you can fit a multi-output network to the usual type of data we have in a pricing file, and that's pretty cool. And then when you run your data through this network, you're actually going to get an answer for each level of the discriminatory characteristic, which you can then use for discrimination-free pricing. What happens, now how do we use all of our available data? So in other words, how can we benefit from using all of the other records? Let's say we're sitting in a case where you've got a pricing file and your discriminatory characteristic is only recorded for, say, 20% of those records. How can we benefit from the other 80% of the records? And the trick that we propose, this is almost the final step, is we use this network to predict both the prices and the probabilities of the discriminatory characteristic. So what we do is we feed our non-discriminatory characteristics into a network that now both gives you a prediction of your prices and the probability that this particular record is either for a male or female if we're talking about gender. So how do we train this? There's two cases. Let's say D is available. So then exactly as we said on this slide, just train the network to match both the example that you give it in terms of prices, or I should say claims experience, as well as the probability that this is in fact the observed level of your discriminatory characteristics. And let's talk about the other case. Let's say D is not available for this record. So then train the network to predict the unawareness price. And the way that you're going to predict the unawareness price is we've got an estimate of the prices, we've got an estimate of the probabilities given the inputs, multiply those prices through by the probabilities, and that is effectively your unawareness price that we use on an everyday basis in normal personal lines and insurance pricing. So if you combine these two cases, this is the final part, you get a new loss function. The first part of it is only if you do have discriminatory information for that particular record, then you can use the loss function as an indicator variable. If you have some discriminatory information, you can calculate the probabilities. That's the second part of the loss function. And then the third part of the loss function is also try to get your unawareness price as close as possible to the observed claims experience. So what's the conclusion? We can now train a multi-output network to provide discrimination-free prices using data that both includes discriminatory characteristics and sometimes, or even most times, excludes the discriminatory characteristics. So let's have a look at the same example that we had before. We've got the same sort of costs in this health insurance example. Remember, 45% of the portfolio are women. The probability of being a smoker unconditionally is 30%. The probability of being a smoker, given that you're a woman, is 80%. So these are some models and some baseline results. What we did is we fit several models to this data set. We've got a plain, and this is the case when we know the discriminatory characteristics for all of the records. So on the left, we've got a normal neural network model, and what we're showing is just the observed prices, the true best estimate, and the fit of the neural net. You can see it fits pretty nicely in this case. A multi-output neural network, that's when you get it to produce prices but for both genders, and you can see the multi-output network is pretty similar to the normal neural net. And then finally, we have a multi-task network. And the multitask network uses makes predictions also of the probabilities. And actually, if you look at a score, and this I'm not going to go into how we've calculated the score, but the score shows that the multi-output network is almost as good as a fully connected neural net, and the multitask network is almost as good as the multi-output network. Now, this is what we've all been waiting for, hopefully. This is what happens if we've got missing data. So what we did is we took the same data set and we started dropping out the discriminatory information. And we took it in 10% increments from 100% of the data being available down to only 10% of the records having the data. On the left-hand part of the slide, we show the best estimate prices. How close does a neural net fit only to those records having the discriminatory information. How well does that predict the true best estimate price versus how well does our multitask neural network predict the price? And you can see that at, say, 10% of the data, your predictions from your normal neural net are quite terrific, but this multitask network actually does pretty well, and they cross over in terms of performance at about 60% of information being available. For discrimination-free prices, the picture's even better. The plain neural network doesn't do so well after about 50%, but in fact, the performance of the multitask network only decreases very gradually as you start dropping out more and more information. So what we can really conclude from this is using the multitask framework in the specially designed multi-output network, you get to a case where you can deal with missing discriminatory information and still perform discrimination-free prices. So let's conclude the talk, and then I'll hand back to Sias for some questions. In cases of full data availability, the multitask network basically performs roughly as well as your normal neural network. In the case of missing data, your multitask network by far outperforms your normal neural net. This opens the door to test and implement discrimination-free pricing in practical settings. And how can you do this? You could maybe pay some policyholders a little bit more if they're willing to disclose sensitive characteristics like gender in the EU or ethnicity and race in South Africa. While there might be some selection bias, some experiments that we did, which we didn't show here, show that the multitask network is also robust to selection bias, or you could perhaps try this using some sort of survey sampling technique. So thanks very much, Sias, for giving me the opportunity to discuss this with you today, and I'll be happy to take any questions.
Thanks, Ron. We do have some questions.
Hi, Ron. This is Riyad. I like to talk. I think certainly you're talking about, you know, factors that we can exclude that, you know, probably are legally allowed but inappropriate. I think my first comment is that it can be quite complicated, and there might be multiple layers of correlation that might exist. For example, like some insured, you can argue that it's correlated to income, and then income you can say is correlated to race. So we could go to a level to say you can't use sum insured as a factor, and as we know, that's quite an important factor. So I guess one theory is that pricing should be done purely based on factors that are more behaviors or things that somebody can change, you know, like smoker status for life, you know, maybe excessive speeding for short term, maybe marital status, maybe occupation, and not really factors that you can't change, you know, like height for life and like gender for short term, etc. So my question is really, what is the guidelines or principles as to what is really a discriminatory factor and what we could actually use for pricing?
Riyad, thanks. That's a really good question. I mean, I fully agree that in an ideal world, you'd use, I guess, what you call risk factors and not rating factors, right? Where there is also some policyholder control over it, and you'd only be pricing for those factors where there's almost a choice to be more risky. I think it's a really interesting point about multiple levels of correlation. I think that the basic idea of the discrimination-free pricing probably would still hold even in a complex correlation structure, but I fully take your point that it's not necessarily as simple as the almost idealized example I'm showing here. And then guidelines. I mean, I think for the guidelines on discriminatory characteristics themselves, that we need to rely on society. But I do think it's an interesting discussion to have in the wider actuarial field, just around where do we believe factors that might be potentially indirectly discriminatory are. What could those factors look like? And is there anything that we as a profession should be doing in this area to say, hey, maybe geography in South Africa is closer or maybe not close to that mark where it becomes indirectly discriminatory. So I don't know if any of that was satisfactory, but yeah, really good question. Thank you.
Ron, thank you for a very captivating talk. My question is around how you manage anti-selection risk. If you're the only insurer who is doing this, you know, non-discriminatory pricing and everyone else is discriminating, then with your example of the ages where, you know, women becoming more expensive, men being cheaper, you know, that people could just jump to your company at some point or jump out at some point.
Sure.
I think just to add on, in healthcare, medical aids, we are forced to not discriminate by age. It works because it's legislated. So in this case, how do you make it work?
I think, again, a really good question. I mean, legislation is one way. Another glib answer that I'll give you is do non-discriminatory pricing, but focus on the cheaper class. I mean, and in a way, many of the wellness schemes that we have in South Africa implicitly do encourage that, if we like it or if we don't. And then I suppose I think it's a good marketing tactic. Start up a UMA, say that you're discrimination-free, and see if you attract higher business volumes. It would at least be innovative. So maybe there's a business strategy in there as well. But I think the real core answer is that as an industry, people would need to decide, hey, this isn't actually acceptable, or it is acceptable, and make the choices accordingly.
Where was the other hand?
Hello. Eric, Ronald. Two questions. The first one is similar to the anti-selection one, and that is, does this not introduce another level of cross-subsidy that you need to manage, monitor, and so on? And the second one is the neural network part. I'm worried about explainability of the model. If something's hidden, how are you going to convince a broker that it's doing something behind the scenes? I'm not sure if you can explain the neural network to a broker and tell him, no, it's fair, and so on.
Yeah, Eric, I really like those questions. Thank you. So on the anti-selection, I mean, you are inducing some level of cross-subsidy, because effectively what you see is that when you apply discrimination-free insurance pricing, you are not predicting costs as closely. But, I mean, cross-subsidy in the name of social good is a concept that we're familiar with as actuaries. I think our previous person asking a question noted that in healthcare, and I think it really comes down to what is your overall preference. I'm not sure necessarily that the traditional view of actuarial fairness is 100% robust from an ethical perspective in 2022. That would be my honest answer. Explainability, yeah, absolutely. You could use an explainable neural network. We've got one called the local GLMNet, and that's going to be presented at the ASSA convention. And that solves the problem of explainability, at least in a local, from the local perspective. And I'd be very happy to send you the reference on that and hear your views if that does solve the explainability problem. So I just say use an explainable neural network rather. So for the purpose of this, it's just to show, hey, you can use the technique, but I suppose there's all sorts of different classes of model in what you'd call the differentiable model class that can easily be adapted to do discrimination-free pricing, even in the case of missing data.
To check, is there any more hands? Okay, Naron, that's it. No more hands. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Sias, and have a wonderful rest of the seminar.